Kia ora and welcome to Te Kuaka. Thank you for tuning in. Today's episode is AUKUS, Alliances and Militarization in Asia Pacific. This episode was recorded in November 2021. Since then, Russia invaded Ukraine. European states are rushing to remilitarize and are rethinking military alliances. With this backdrop, it is important that we understand what is happening in our corner of the world. In this podcast, Nina Hall speaks with Maureen Penjuli, Jia Ian Chong, and Marco De Jong about how AUKUS and the nuclear-powered submarines the Security Pact invites into Pacific waters changes relationships and security in Asia Pacific.
Kia ora all. AUKUS, Alliances and Militarization in the Asia Pacific is the topic of today's Te Kuaka podcast. We're here to get a handle on what exactly AUKUS is and what its implications are for relationships and security in the Asia Pacific region. Now, for those of you who haven't heard of AUKUS, it's a military alliance announced by the Australians, UK and the US in September this year. And this military alliance has been widely criticized on at least two fronts. Firstly, it was an absolute diplomatic disaster. None of the three countries involved informed their allies that they were about to make this announcement. And in fact, the announcement saw Australia snub the French in favor of the Americans and the UK because they opted to buy nuclear-powered submarines from the Americans and the UK over a long-standing contract they had with the French. The French were outraged. They said so, both the Foreign Minister and Macron. Macron even called out Scott Morrison for lying and not informing him. And they recalled their ambassador. And those diplomatic tensions continue. But quite apart from the relationship with France, a second, more substantive critique is whether this sort of military alliance and these sorts of technology will really make the Pacific more safe and secure, as Biden, Boris Johnson, and Scott Morrison have proposed. The underlying assumption in this military alliance is that it will counter China's increased power, both economic and military, and that the best way to do so is with more military might. But what's been missing in this broader discussion is an analysis of what other countries in the Pacific and in Asia really want. Do they see increased military might helping deliver more safety and security in the region? What do they want? Do they want to see, for instance, nuclear-powered submarines in the Pacific? What is the best way to navigate these increased tensions between China and the US? And I have a great lineup of speakers to discuss these very issues. The first is Marco De Jong, a Samoan New Zealander and a Pacific historian. He's currently completing a doctorate at the University of Oxford on the history of the environmental movement in the Pacific, with a focus on anti-nuclearism and climate change. He spoke to us from Oxford. He just recently returned from the UNFCCC summit in Glasgow, the UK. Our second speaker is Maureen Penjuli. She's the coordinator of the Pacific Network on Globalization and is based in Suva, Fiji. She's worked in the nonprofit sector for over 20 years on environment, economic, political, and social justice in the Pacific. She spoke to us from Fiji, but she'd just been at the Glasgow Climate Summit as well. And we'll hear from both Marco and Maureen a little bit about what happened at that summit alongside their analysis of AUKUS. Third speaker is Ian Chong. He's an associate professor at the National University of Singapore, where he teaches international relations. He has a special interest in IR theory, security, Chinese foreign policy, and international relations in the Asia Pacific. And I started our conversation by asking them, what exactly was the immediate reaction in Southeast Asia and in the Pacific to the AUKUS announcement?
So the response across Southeast Asia was actually fairly interesting because, as you'd expect, with 10 very different states, there were a variety of different responses. So I think the most notable responses were from Malaysia and Indonesia, and then Singapore. I think also the Philippines had a bit of a response, but others, the other six ASEAN members didn't really say very much. Now, among the four countries that did respond, I think the Philippines was quite open to AUKUS, which I think also marks a change in their current government's position, which they got the current administration started off as being very enthusiastic about working with China and quite eager to drop or lower ties with the US. So given the ongoing disputes over the South China Sea, the government has changed its position. Singapore, I think, took a position that was very similar to New Zealand, meaning to say that they essentially stated that, you know, having more cooperation, more coordination is a good thing. They didn't express any sort of a desire to join or anything like that. Bearing in mind that Singapore also is you know, has deep cooperative relationships over security with all of the AUKUS members. Actually, we are in the five power defense arrangement together with Australia and the UK. That also includes New Zealand. We also have a strategic partnership with the United States. Now, on the part of Malaysia and Indonesia, they raised some skepticism. They had some concerns over whether AUKUS would be stabilizing. But what was interesting about their remarks was that right after the statements were out, Malaysia, you know, went ahead and continued with the Five Power Defense Arrangement 50th anniversary. That included UK and Australian forces. They, you know, were quite happy to back that and see those exercises and meetings come into place. They also had a bunch of military exchanges with the US, right? Indonesia also expressing some skepticism, but right after that, they also had a military exercise with the US. So I think all in all, what this sort of very mixed picture tells us is while there is at least some verbal expression of skepticism, there is a general view that having the US, UK, Australia more involved in the region might have a stabilizing effect in view of China's increasing pressure on the region. Of course, those that remain silent, I suppose for them, either they felt more sort of caught in between Washington and Beijing, or they felt that you know, there was they didn't want to express a position either way, despite what they might have otherwise felt. Sorry, a bit long because there's so many sort of different variables at play here.
Yeah, it's great, and we'll come back to some of the points that you noted. But let's hear from Marco and Maureen. What were the views of Pacific Island countries? Were they, you know, supportive of AUKUS, or did they have more skepticism? And if so, why? Maureen, do you want to start? And then Marco, feel free to add in.
The reaction from the Pacific was quite slow, and in a way it was reflective of the announcement itself. I mean, most of our countries woke up to the news. Mainstream news was the medium in which the announcement was made. So obviously there was lots of scrambling around within the diplomatic channels to try and find out the details of the AUKUS announcement and the deal. I think the president of Kiribati came out quite strongly to express deep concerns about AUKUS, particularly because on two points. One is that he felt that AUKUS, the Defense Pact announcement, placed the region at a higher level of risk. And secondly, to really remind Australia of this long and enduring history of nuclear weapons testing in the region, and that particular legacy, which was still being felt, particularly in this country. His statements were also echoed by the Prime Minister of Fiji, who was, I think, at the time at the UNGA. But I think at that time, most of the countries were waiting to hear formally from the Australian government through those diplomatic channels. And, you know, this announcement followed the Japanese government's announcement earlier this year on the Fukushima. So, you know, diplomatically, our countries are receiving news about nuclear matters through mainstream media. So I think there was initially this reaction by two leaders from the Pacific. The Fiji Prime Minister is also the chair of the forum. So I think there were lots of questions about whether the Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum would also be receiving a briefing from the Australian government. And I think that was followed quickly with obviously condemnation quite strongly by civil society groups, churches, academics, because of this very strong anti-nuclear or nuclear-free Pacific history that we have in the Pacific. So a lot of countries abstained from taking a position. Solomon's Prime Minister also put out a statement, and partly because of this whole reaction to the way containment of China is being discussed in the region. So I think there were lots of countries quiet, but those countries that came out to speak out expressed significant concerns about the AUKUS deal.
And yeah, I think that obviously echoing 100% what Maureen's saying, and then just the stance of Australia, the commitment going forward decades, really setting itself on that ambiguous nuclear path, and also expressing commitments that aren't broadly in line with the position on the forum as to regional security concerns, you know, foremost of which is climate change, and then placing the AUKUS deal in the broader context of Australia's climate criminality was another huge reason for concern. As well as the fact that the entire thing was announced, as Maureen says, in mainstream media, meant that this shows a certain disrespect for the mandate of Pacific people over our own ocean, which, is rightfully condemned, I think.
And it's good to remind all of the listeners that not only was the Pacific and many other countries were also very annoyed, if not pissed off, about the way the announcement happened, right? And there was a lot of commentary about the French government, and there continues to be commentary about the French government's frustrations. So I guess bringing us a little bit away from the initial announcement and reactions, what were the substantive concerns? Because for those who are less familiar with AUKUS, one of the parts of it was, of course, that Australia would look to develop nuclear-powered submarines. So these are not submarines that would have nuclear weapons, but would have nuclear power. And coming back to Marco and Maureen, at least initially, why would that be such a problem for Pacific Islanders, for those listeners who are less familiar with the history of the region?
Well, the nuclear propulsion versus nuclear capability question is one that, although at the moment has been pitched as nuclear propulsion, the closer cooperation with the United States on information sharing and training makes the whole question more ambiguous. And in 1985, the Treaty of Rarotonga guarantees that there will be no storage or of nuclear weapons within countries of the region, of which Australia is one. So it's not clear what the Australia's long-term kind of plans are with the nuclear weapons capabilities. Some people would see the nuclear propulsion as the thin end of a wedge and broadly inconsistent with the principles of the Treaty of Rarotonga, which itself is not a very, is not necessarily a strong document, but it did provide a kind of framework for a nuclear-free South Pacific. I think the other thing is that, as Maureen pointed out earlier, is it also signals a continuation. It signals a continuation of militarization of the Pacific, the location of sophisticated military technology in the region long term in the form of bases, and a closer integration of bases through Australia and key points like Guam and Hawaii, you know.
Maureen, do you have?
I think the Marcus point about the submarines themselves isn't really the key concerns. I think there was an additional agreement announced in the same week as AUKUS, which really looked at the Australia's and the US defense arrangements, which would see Australia host US military, US ordinances. It would combine its logistics to undertake warfare in the Pacific. And I think that agreement is the more substantive concern to the region and should be the more substantive concern in addition to the nuclear powered or propulsion, as Marco points out. Because it means that the risk becomes certainly much higher. And under the Rarotonga Treaty, that would be a contravention of the treaty itself, which would require Australia at a minimum to inform the Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum of this particular relationship. But I think what it really points to is really the role that Australia starts to play in the region. It's considered itself to be a sheriff of the region, but now it becomes an armed sheriff through this particular US-Australia agreement around hosting of. So I think that's really where the deep concerns lie, in addition to AUKUS. And I think that's where further attention needs to be paid. The Rarotonga Treaty does require that countries, and Australia the party to Rarotonga Treaty, to at the minimum inform the region of these particular intentions. And as Marco points out, the Pacific Ocean is really, we're kind of in a state of hyper-militarization of the ocean. You know, as far north as Hawaii, Northern Mariana Islands, and then further down south with the French territories and colonies in the Pacific, we are really at a state where this simply adds further militarized roles, nuclear submarines, bases. The announcement of the US moving troops from Japan to Guam, these are all just part of the ongoing hyper-militarization of the Pacific Ocean, with little say by Pacific governments or Pacific peoples in this kind of decision, because it seemed to be in our interest. I mean, Australia views this to be in the best interest. This is about our security, and they've taken these decisions kind of unilaterally.
And that seems to be a really core theme of AUKUS, is that this militarization will help peace and security. And so I wonder, Ian, can you clarify, how do countries in the Southeast Asian region see this? Do they see peace and security through militarization?
Well, there is a militarized aspect to relations in Southeast Asia. That's really become more prominent since the end of the first decade of the 21st century. This is not just the US, and I suppose what you're seeing in the Pacific is a response, right? It has a lot to do with China, an assertive China. And so a lot of AUKUS, the sort of intent seems to be to somehow safeguard against it. So in Southeast Asia, I suppose, different countries will fall on different sides of this, but in essence, the militarization has been going on and has been intensifying. Some of your listeners may be aware that China has been seizing and terraforming and also militarizing features in the South China Sea. There is a submarine base on Hainan Island, a major submarine base that hosts China's nuclear submarines, including its nuclear ballistic missile submarines. So there are nuclear weapons to the northern end of the South China Sea. And just in case people don't have a sense of the geography, Hainan is about the same latitude as northern Vietnam. So what's happened at the beginning of last week was there was a ASEAN-China summit, and the PRC under its leader Xi Jinping said that it would join this zone of peace, freedom, and neutrality, ZOPFAN, we call it in Southeast Asia. It was established in it was an agreement established in 1971 that talks about having a nuclear-free zone in Southeast Asia. It does not exclude nuclear propulsion, but what it does exclude is nuclear weapons. So the question that comes up, right, is whether the PRC will be removing their nuclear weapons from Hainan Island, which it seems unlikely. But at any rate, that's sort of one end of the equation. And so given greater PRC pressure, there are a number of states in Southeast Asia who I think are more welcoming of some sort of response by larger stakeholders, Australia, the United States, Japan, Korea, India, in a way that can blunt the pressure that the PRC is putting on militarily. So I suppose based on those considerations, the view of AUKUS is slightly different. While I think nobody wants an escalation, but there is also a sense that increased military pressure from the PRC could mean less scope for autonomy. It could mean more. More pressure to conform or comply with PRC preferences that may not necessarily be in line with the sort of interests of the state in the region. So there's that friction, right, with the PRC that makes AUKUS and also the Quad more prominent and more welcome in certain quarters.
Can you just explain what the Quad is for anyone that doesn't know?
Oh. Right. So the Quad is this other arrangement that the U.S. has that includes essentially democracies in Asia, and also the U.S. So I guess in the sort of Pacific Asia. So you have India, you have Australia, Japan, and the United States that are part of the Quad. So they're supposed to coordinate on a variety of things, including on security-related matters. It's not a formal arrangement in the way that AUKUS is, but certainly it allows for some sort of coordinated response and communication should there be issues, should issues of common concern arise.
And that predates Biden, of course, right? So the Quad
Yes.
is an older form of alliance, came up under Trump, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, actually, it's much older than that. It came up under Abe. Abe, in his first term as prime minister, so this would be in the early mid 2000s, when he sort of proposed this sort of grouping of democracies, and it was something that was there. It became dormant for a while. Trump picked it up again, and now the Biden administration has continued with it. It was originally called something like the Arc of Democracy. It had a bunch of strange names, but I think it settled on the Quad now.
And I think it's important to mention, because as you've all hinted at, the big question, the elephant in the room, of course, is how each country not just views AUKUS, but views China, right? And so I guess in trying to unpack a little bit further these questions, has AUKUS changed the game significantly in terms of the geopolitics in the region? Is it, we've got the Quad already. There have already been major geopolitical tensions over the last decades between the US and China, also in the Pacific. To what extent does AUKUS represent something distinctively new?
I think the only new bit is the real central question around Australia's role, which is a little bit elevated in security pact discussions before. We've seen Australia in deep, initially with France. They've released, white papers, defense papers. But I think this really comes down to what is Australia's role in the region and the escalation of their role in this region. I mean, we are well aware of the role of the US, more specifically, given its bases, particularly in the North Pacific. And I also think that the UK is also making an entry back into the region as a result of Brexit. So we're seeing this incursion first under the Indo-Pacific arrangements and agreements. But I think the new part is the real central question around what is Australia's role in the region within security defense matters. I think that's the new component that's added here. We've been in a space where, you know, France has been very active. Of course, the US has been very active. Both these two major powers through their territories in the Pacific and obviously in Asia gives them some of the largest ocean powers, if you like. So, you know, this is, for me, it's almost like we are coming back to the traditional nuclear powers escalating their presence in the region. And it's a containment strategy for China. So that, you know, that's the response. For many of our countries, they really hold nuanced diplomatic relations with China, foreign policy, which is really around enemies to none, friends to all. And that's really just a reflection of how small our countries are. You know, we don't have the kinds of leveraging, so we cannot be seen to be picking sides in these kinds of tensions between these kinds of major powers. But I think for me, the central question is what is Australia's intention and vision in the region at this stage with the announcement of AUKUS?
Mark, do you have other points to add on that question?
And building on that, it's clear that Australia has kind of mid-power ambitions, but its priorities do not seem to be broadly consistent with regional sentiment. Its position, as Maureen says, is more aggressive towards China. The whole AUKUS deal can be seen as a kind of a response to heightened kind of diplomatic animosity between Canberra and Beijing, and then the opportunistic inclusion of post-Brexit Britain. But really, in terms of kind of aid flows, although Australia is the largest donor in the region, this kind of signaling that it's prioritizing military as opposed to kind of development assistance as funding shows, as well as its lack of action on climate, among other things, and shows that really it's out of step. It's out of step and has been for a decade. So the question now is how, if they have mid-power ambitions or are the sheriff in the region, as Maureen says, what does that look like going forward? And we can only guess at this point, but there's plenty of concern that that the priorities of the Quad, the priorities of the Indo-Pacific are going to be superimposed upon the region. And we're going to be informed last minute via media press release. It's clear there's no consultation, and thus no inclusion of Pacific voice or Pacific priorities.
Is there a similar sentiment in Ian in Southeast Asia? Are people frustrated with the, you know?
Actually, I guess in a really sad way, no, because I think there's a lot of familiarity with major powers just sort of doing what they want to do. So there's no expectation of consultation. This is just what happens. Although I would have to say that being in Southeast Asia means also that we are more at the forefront of US-China friction. So some of the things that Australia had been complaining about in terms of meddling in domestic politics by the PRC, the sort of punishment in terms of economics when the diplomacy goes sour, that's something that, you know, a lot of countries in Southeast Asia tend to face a little bit more. So in that sense, I suppose to have more options of groups and people to work with is better than not having it. So in that sense, I suppose the immediacy of the sort of frictions, right, in Southeast Asia creates a slightly different perspective from the Pacific. And I suppose there is a view that to the extent that there are more actors involved in Southeast Asia, it actually has a pacifying effect in the sense that you have more stakeholders there. There are more things to consider on the table to consider, such that the sort of major powers that may give the major powers some pause before they decide to escalate.
Interesting. And I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit, Ian, because I know in a previous conversation we'd had, you'd said that China often mobilizes its diaspora for its own purposes. And you were sort of suggesting that then. Can you clarify what that looks like? I mean, what's the sort of examples of how that happens in your region?
So what has been sort of going on in this sort of periodic reporting in the press is essentially that the PRC tries to work with, sometimes to mobilize ethnic Chinese diaspora to lobby in its favor, to sort of push narratives that are in its favor. This is in some ways not surprising, in the sense that there's a group of people who the PRC feels some affinity to, and the feeling is likewise. So, you know, it's a easy way in to connect with the society. So some of the investment, the economic and commercial links will go through the ethnic Chinese communities. I suppose there's a debate on whether they are diaspora, because the idea of diaspora suggests that there's some place of origin in China, and some ethnic Chinese would dispute that. Now, so that has been going on historically, even before the PRC was created. Different groups, such as the Kuomintang, the Qing government, they all tried to reach out to ethnic Chinese communities in the region to gain support, sometimes to raise funds. This was also apparent during the Second World War. So the PRC has some, in some ways, inherited that you know, dynamic. And for a while during the Cold War, during the Cultural Revolution, they were, you know, using ethnic Chinese communities to export revolution. They stopped after they did opening and reform, and ties got actually quite good. So what seems to be going on now is that there's a repoliticization of the ethnic Chinese communities to sort of push the PRC narrative. And I suppose it's a very natural extension of policy for them. There is a opportunity, why not use it? But the issue too is that for ethnic Chinese communities in the region, in this very ethnically diverse region, there has been also a history of tensions where sometimes ethnic differences become a trigger point for other social and economic problems that are going on, and it can sometimes turn violent. The most sort of recent and obvious case of this would be in 1998 in Indonesia, in the wake of the Asian financial crisis. So while what the PRC is doing, you know, there's a very clear logic to it, there are risks to the ethnic Chinese community in Southeast Asia. There are risks to inter-ethnic relations. So that's something I suppose is useful to watch. And for governments, I think they would want to manage it. And there's a Australian angle to this. So some of the discussion about Australia facing pressure from the PRC, facing the mobilization of their ethnic Chinese communities, parts of which were helping to sort of censor other kinds of discussion. I mean, this takes on a very similar flavor, right? Essentially, the sort of use of things like clan associations, business associations to do this sort of work. And then a lot of it then gets embroiled into sort of inter-ethnic tensions, whether it's sort of anti-Chinese in some way, whether it's just really about, you know, not liking certain kinds of behavior. And so there's a backdrop of certain, the backdrop is that there's a risk, right, of tensions that nobody really wants to see.
And I guess, you know, I have to add in here, I'm recording this just after several days of rioting in Solomon Islands, which was targeting Chinatown. And I heard on the radio this morning that, you know, hundreds of jobs have been lost and, you know, not to mention lives harmed. I wonder, Maureen, Marco, either of you want to comment a little bit on how we can understand the way that these geopolitical tensions play out in a place like the Solomons, because those riots were specifically targeting Chinatown. Uh, either of you, Maureen or Marco.
Mark, do you want to have a go?
Yeah, I sure can, Maureen. I always just defer to you. Sorry. In the Solomons, you know, this anti-China sentiment in the Pacific is not new, but, you know, there's been riots, I think 2004 in Nuku'alofa, and then there's ongoing kind of issues elsewhere. But I think it's important, and then there's also the kind of feeling recently in Fiji around certain labor projects, the importing of Chinese labor to fill large infrastructure projects. But I think it's important to balance that also with the long ties the Pacific have with China, large kind of not even diasporic populations, 100 years plus. So that is an ambivalence. And it's also important to contextualize it for some of our listeners that, you know, the Pacific broadly doesn't necessarily see China as so different, or Asian populations so different. You know, there's deep ties, voyaging ties to Taiwan and to kind of, you know, through Austronesian migration. So it's not that question of othering or difference is not felt as strongly everywhere, although it must be said that, yeah, the situation in the Solomons is concerning, and it does have a near history. And Sinophobia is a very real thing.
Yeah, I think if you listen to the Prime Minister of the Solomon Islands, his response is actually quite clear. He's clear that this is about foreign influence, really stirring up these anti-China sentiments at the grounds, which is reflected in the burning of Chinatown in Honiara over the last couple of days. It's deeply rooted since the change from Taiwan to recognition of China. And there's definitely a link. There's been huge debates and discussions internally within the Solomon Islands about these two major players. So I think that's the kinds of tension that plays out in very across the Pacific, particularly Taiwan-China relationships. So we've seen, you know, Solomons through Tsongkhavari switch alliances. Kiribati has certainly switched alliances, and people are watching that quite closely. But in recognition of these kinds of switches taking place, we are seeing the kinds of overt American presence also to match the kind of disperception of the Chinese incursion in the region. When I speak to a lot of the officials at basic government level around relationships between external partners, their view is that China is just more accommodating, and particularly around financing. Their preference would be to go to Australia or New Zealand for financing. Multilateral banks is next to impossible. So for a lot of them, this relationship with China is around aid, loans, grants, if you like, to the country. But it comes with these kinds of contracts, which sees you know, having to take on a state entity in resource extraction sectors where, you know, meeting of basic environmental standards in countries. This has been the case in PNG, where, you know, a lot of these companies, state-owned companies, have not been abiding by national laws. So obviously the Chinese government has been working very hard at the global level, really to improve its state-owned enterprises and the way they behave in other countries. And attached to that is labor. So, you know, part of the contracts for access to loans is that Chinese labor comes in. And that creates all kinds of tensions around infrastructure projects, whether they're roads, wharfs, mines, particularly in PNG. So it raises lots of tension with local communities in that sense. because you have a huge influx of labor coming in. A lot of efforts taken place to try to bring in some cultural understanding. And so that's where diaspora communities or, you know, Chinese communities that have been here for generations, they play this role to navigate between local communities and the influx of labor that's coming in, particularly from China, associated with state-owned enterprises. They're capturing a lot of our what is considered very vibrant parts of our economies. They're capturing it, replacing local firms. So, you know, there is this ongoing suspicion and tension around that. But when you speak to government officials, their view is it's easier to access loans from China than it is from Australia. And so they will go with China with all these kinds of conditionalities because they understand.
Can I just jump in on a couple of points? So one is that this contestation over diplomatic recognition between Taiwan and China has been ongoing for a while, really since the 60s and 70s. Now, one of the downsides of this historically is that it becomes a pathway for corruption and bad governance, because essentially what Beijing and Taipei do is they offer money to politicians to, you know, switch or maintain ties. And so that becomes a windfall for certain politicians and means for payoff. And that obviously can create a lot of tension on the ground, especially when certain politicians sort of use that wealth to fund their security services and things like that. It's not unique to the Pacific. It's something that, you know, has been going on in Latin America, in Africa. And that has a sort of lasting legacy, right, where the sort of contest for diplomatic recognition can be quite devastating for local communities. The fortunate thing is that I think Taiwan is sort of not doing that anymore, in part because they can't compete monetarily with China, but also as they've democratized, I think they've had a different view on what it means to engage. So there's that legacy that is somewhat changing. The other thing I wanted to raise is that with major infrastructure projects, there is always, I think, a big sort of potential for disruption, whether this is American infrastructure building, whether this is French or British or Chinese or whoever, right? And it's the sort of disruption that we've seen with major PRC infrastructure projects associated with the Belt and Road. In some ways, we've seen some of that with the big projects to sort of build stuff, whether you're talking about the Trans-Siberian Railroad or whether you're thinking about the cross-continental railroad to the Pacific, done by the Canadians and the Americans, right? That certainly was very devastating for local communities. This is something that comes with infrastructure and the sort of big moneyed interests that are associated. So there's no reason why the PRC infrastructure projects would be any exception to this. So the infrastructure projects that we've seen in Southeast Asia, they also come with a lot of these issues where there's paying off of people, local power brokers, there's insufficient compliance with environmental standards, so on and so forth, and the dam building on the Mekong has been very damaging to the river ecosystem, and also has affected quite severely the local sort of fishing communities along the river. So this is something that comes with infrastructure, and I suppose when we want development, this is sort of the downside that I think sometimes people tend to forget. And in this sense, it's not really a Chinese problem. I think it's an infrastructure and big money problem that maybe in the search for development, we sometimes forget. And this is, I think, also related to the labor issues. Yes, the PRC has never been really great on labor issues, but in order to sort of move forward on those cheap infrastructure projects, one reason why they're able to keep costs down is precisely because they are bringing skilled semi-skilled labor from China. They don't need to retrain anybody. They are at relatively low wages. They ship people over to do the work. So the building gets done. It's just that while I suppose there's a long-term benefit from infrastructure if it's well-built and well-designed, but in the short term, what it does is it crowds out local labor, and it may create competition for local businesses as the sort of ancillary services get set up. So sometimes when we think about development, and you know, these are the nitty-gritty things that add up that that people forget about, unfortunately.
Hmm. I wonder if Maureen or Marco want to respond to that, because I guess one thing, and I'm by far not the expert here, you three are, is that you often read that China is more interested in investing in big infrastructure, whereas other donors are less interested now. They may be doing other things like, you know, good government or good governance or democracy promotion, supporting civil society organizations or the press. So one of the responses might be, Ian, you know, while, you know, big infrastructure does have their problems, China is just doing more big infrastructure mm-hmm. than many other donors.
Right. Right. But that means it's not necessarily a China thing, right? It's the fact that they've been doing big infrastructure.
Mm. So Marco or Maureen, did you have any responses or thoughts on that? You don't have to have them.
I think, you know, it's important to see the rise in Chinese infrastructure building in the Pacific as filling a space that's left by New Zealand and Australia, who aren't willing to do that intense capital development now. But we should always remember that New Zealand and Australia did try their hand right through the later half of the 20th century, and it did end up in some disastrous projects. We only have to think of Bougainville. We can think of the Ōkeri environmental disaster. We can think of the forestry development in Fiji and Samoa. You know, those had terrible environmental side effects that are consistent with what Ian's describing across all, you know, major development programs. But yeah, I agree with you, Nina. We have to see it in that context. China's offering something, which is kind of loans or grants that aren't tied in the same way as New Zealand and Australian ones, and Pacific still feels the need to develop to play the world game, and so that opportunity is being seized upon.
Mm. I wonder if we could sort of step back and ask a slightly different question, which is, where and when have people resisted this kind of being pawns of geopolitics, resisted this forms of militarization? Are there examples where countries in either Southeast Asia or the Pacific have been able to do that successfully? And Maureen, I think you had some insights into that.
Well, yes, I think, you know, if you look at some very successful negotiations by the parties of the Nauru Agreement, so this is a group of very small countries, but have some of the richest tuna resources flowing through the EEZs, they've been able to collectively negotiate better deals with, you know, the biggest fishing nations in the world, whether it's the European Union or the US, but leveraging China. And I think this is a sophistication with many of our countries today, is that they understand that you can't leverage China in ways that accrues benefit really to your people. So the fisheries negotiations that they just re-signed with the US was quite fraught, because the US just assumed that these are just really, really small island countries that you can just turn over with, you know, just by might. But the countries really held this in terms of their solidarity. They negotiated hard and said, look, if you don't buy our fish at this particular price and under these rules, we will sell it to China, who's simply waiting in the wings to access resources. So I think the fisheries is just one case study where Pacific Island countries have been very, very successful. And I think secondly, a lot of our particularly diplomats now understand this. whether, you know, they come from small countries like Samoa or Fiji, if you speak to them, they really understand what it means to have China as a leveraging card for them. We've seen countries resolve kind of disputes that on the international front, would seem impossible to resolve, but, you know, people-to-people relationships can resolve things like territorial disputes and boundaries. And this is the case between Vanuatu, New Caledonia, and Fiji over one particular island, which France claimed as part of its territory, but the people of both Kanaki in New Caledonia and Vanuatu simply moved to resolve this through indigenous cultural practices and knowledge systems to do that. And this is really to confront France. And I think the region has a whole lot of history of its ability to demonstrate that they can wield very sophisticated ways of responding to problems. Things like drift net fishing, people just said it was impossible to do that. But the Pacific used its one vote in the UN system to do a lot of these kinds of negotiation. And it's one of the reasons why there is such grant for the Pacific agency and diplomacy consistently, because they understand that the Pacific can leverage this in ways that can serve and in the interest of their people consistently. So I think those are just some examples of resisting. And obviously the key one is really bringing France to stopping nuclear testing. I mean, if you were during those days, it seemed impossible. It seemed like that you could not bring an end to those nuclear tests in French-occupied Tahiti, Polynesia at that stage. And yet, these are countries that understood the power of one vote, one country, one vote, real solidarity, really to confront the kinds of hegemonic powers that we always think that we can't overturn. So I think these are some of the lessons that the Pacific constantly push and advocate for, that it's possible to do things and accrue benefit and leverage these kinds of power dynamics to the benefit of your people.
Yeah, and building off what Maureen says, Maureen and I have just been at COP, and the Pacific is instrumental as one of the key coalitions within AOSIS, the Alliance of Small Island States, as Pacific Small Island Developing States. And since the scale of the impending crisis became known in the late 80s, the Pacific have set the agenda consistently. AOSIS was instrumental in establishing a lot of the key lines of argument about the importance of things like compensation for loss and damage, having equitable carbon markets, adequate climate financing, in the early 90s. And those are still the things that we're arguing about now. And most recently in the, in the Paris Agreement, the enshrinement of the 1.5 degrees consistent with, keeping coral alive, and the product of negotiation and addition last minute by the High Ambition Coalition. These are the Pacific's, gift to the world, in terms of the Pacific bloc diplomacy has had a lot of wins, setting the agenda, pushing back against the hegemonic powers. That is consistent across the board.
Yeah, so I mean, I agree this ability to bargain collectively is very important. And when you talk about resistance, Nina, I think in Southeast Asia, we have a very mixed set of results. So on fisheries, it's also a big thing for maritime Southeast Asia here. We've not really had very much success, largely because various actors weren't able to get together. And there's not really an ability to set the agenda to bargain with big fishing fleets that come from China and also Taiwan, frankly. So what we've seen is this collapse of fish stocks in the northern sector of the South China Sea. It's leading more fishing fleets from the Philippines, Vietnam, China, etc., to move south into the sort of southern sector of the South China Sea. That's creating more friction, in particular with Indonesia, who for a while had been trying to impound these fishing vessels and sinking them, making them into artificial coral, to sort of demonstrate the how upset they are. But part of this is because of the collapse in fish stocks and an inability to really manage the fisheries. And if this persists, right now there's more fishing in the southern part of the South China Sea, but in time that will go as well. So this is a real sort of classic case of the tragedy of the commons. But on a more successful note, I think where Southeast Asian states had been able to somewhat get together is to emphasize, because we're relative to China, we're generally a lot smaller, although Indonesia is not small by any sort of measure. They're 240 million people. Neither are the Philippines or Vietnam, right? One is like 100 million, the other is 90 million. They're huge. But relative to China, far less so. So the sort of insistence on using international rule of law, the emphasis on UNCLOS, has been one way to sort of push back, at least legally, but not physically, right, on China's very excessive claims. So on at least on that level, right, there's some there's a denial of legitimation of some of what China is doing in terms of its claims, in terms of its reclamation of features and militarization. Although, you know, in terms of the sort of actual, you know, physical control of these things, that's not much other actors can really do at this point. But I mean, at least on some level, that's where your collective action is sort of coming together. And I guess it's also interesting to compare this with the Pacific case, because here you have states that are much bigger, states that are much stronger on many levels, having a much more mixed set of results in terms of trying to push back, right? And a lot of this comes down to the ability to work together, which is mixed. It's sort of also complicated by the fact that Beijing is trying to peel off certain actors, and others sort of feel that they are more able to stand on their own, such as Indonesia, so they don't need to work with everyone else. And that more muddied picture degrades the ability to bargain collectively against the sort of larger actors.
This is really interesting. And as we sort of round off the conversation, I want to bring New Zealand back in, because we started sort of quoting with New Zealand's position on AUKUS as kind of trying to have it both ways, if you like. And I wondered if you could all reflect, you know, do the regions that you're experts on, are they concerned about New Zealand's position? New Zealand, obviously, particularly in the Pacific, has said, you know, this is our home. This is Jacinda Ardern. I quote her, it is the region we most squarely identify with. We very, you know, this is where New Zealand situates itself in the world. And at the same time, as Ian will know well, our foreign minister was just in Indonesia for her first foreign visit and made a special speech to ASEAN. So she's obviously also prioritizing Southeast Asia very strongly. So how would you reflect on New Zealand's position in your respective regions? And is there anything that you would want to counsel New Zealanders to be aware of in what we're doing or not doing, or our government at least? Who wants to start? Marco, you look ready.
Sure. Well, it's interesting, you know, it seems like New Zealand has had a slight shift from, you know, Pacific Reset to Pacific Resilience. Now Mahuta has kind of trying to bring Indigenous worldviews into the way New Zealand does foreign policy, which itself is new, and we're all wondering how it will go. I know Phoebe has talked about it already, so we can refer our listeners to that. I think the question for me would be that, are you able to hold those things, all of these ideas, concurrently? Are you able to, you know, endorse the priorities of AUKUS and the Indo-Pacific, whilst also arguing for Pacific resilience, if that resilience, you know, has things like climate at the forefront of it and continued human development, which is directly at odds with the militarization we're seeing in the region. Are you able to incorporate indigenous worldviews and have the Pacific and the whakapapa of Māori back across foraging homelands? Is that consistent with, you know, renewed ties with Australia and the UK, which are colonial powers, and loop New Zealand back into that old world kind of view of things? The other thing is that if that is incoherent, which I personally think it is, we need to think back and think that this is not the first time New Zealand has tried again to position itself in the region, and continually since the, you know, before the 60s. And even prior, when New Zealand itself was an imperial power in the early 1900s, New Zealand continuously finds itself at odds with the region, out of step. And I fear that we're drifting towards Australia's ambivalence, whereas previously, when we weren't so open with, you know, our support of militarization, or even, you know, the kind of ambivalence we're seeing now. I'm not too sure. I'm a bit conflicted about it. I feel like there's some benefits in terms of the increase in aid funding and direct contributions to the Pacific. It's nice to hear it talked about, but it's always put in conversation with our other kind of obligations. And as you say, you know, the publicly facing ones will always talk about the Pacific. Behind closed doors, people will talk about ASEAN, talk about Southeast Asia. So, yeah, I remain to be convinced. But I look forward to seeing how Mahuta's foreign policy develops. And I certainly hope it goes well.
Thanks, Marco. Ian, did you have a response? And then we'll go to Maureen.
So, generally speaking, for Southeast Asia, the more actors are involved, the better. And I suppose New Zealand does have something to bring in terms of its sort of view of having more sustainable development and to sort of put those things on the table. Because honestly, the region, while we need to take care of our environment desperately, governments have been unfortunately very spotty on this, and they need to be their attention needs to be more focused on environment and climate change, which is not so. You might notice from COP26 that Southeast Asia wasn't particularly active. In fact, you know, we were quite happy to go along with the sort of coal and all that, because there's a very strong sort of developmentalist mindset among the establishment here. So, you know, it's growth and wealth above other things that may actually be important. And it's not even for the long term anymore. So that sort of constant reminder and pull, I think, is important. Now, I suppose with the New Zealand role as well, there's it's useful to have an actor that you know, is in many ways also sort of economically tied. I mean, I think the sort of trade side is and investment side is we're quite linked. So that's good to have. Although really since the 60s and 70s, though, you know, there's been far less attention to New Zealand in Southeast Asia. You know, as New Zealand sort of went off to focus on the Pacific, and you know, has been less so of a player. So I guess having New Zealand in would be welcome. But there are specific roles that New Zealand can play, but it's a matter of whether they will adopt that sort of a position and how they do so, because it's a bit tricky, right? If governments are not that interested in environmental concerns, and New Zealand say, well, this is something that you really need to do, while there's, I think there'll be a lot of resonance with civil society, you know, some of these establishment types might be less taken than it than, by this sort of claim, right? It's about growth in the end for these folks.
And I think, I mean, that deserves its own podcast. I think we'll have to put that down for next year about development, growth, and climate change. And but yeah, thanks for outlining those tensions, Ian. And I think it's certainly on the minds of many New Zealanders is how do we, not just within our own New Zealand economy, make it more, reduce our climate emissions, but what do we do in terms of climate diplomacy? Maureen, did you have any remarks on this final reflection on sort of what New Zealand's foreign policy towards the Pacific and whether we really are acting in New Zealand in the Pacific's interests? And feel free to draw on your experiences at COP.
That's a very good question. I think, you know, traditionally we tend to pay attention to Australia. You know, Australia's kind of, we know Australia's always been seen as out of step with the Pacific and Pacific interests. We've always felt we aligned with Australia. But increasingly, we've been a little bit more cautious with the New Zealand government's foreign policies. And I think Marcus's point is that there is a misstep in several key areas that's really significant for the Pacific. Trade being one of those areas where we're seeing a New Zealand that's quite capitalist in its intent around market access in the region. You know, the ability for the Pacific to send produce to New Zealand remains at all time high and quite difficult. So a lot of people wonder whether, you know, New Zealand in the area of trade has the Pacific interest at heart. So I think that's one area. We've seen a real misstep in the whole diplomacy around vaccines and the pandemic itself. I mean, we were quite surprised at how quickly New Zealand kind of just locked down its border, and the narrative was this is to protect us in the Pacific, when the reality is that our economy is really integrated into New Zealand and Australia. Those kinds of decisions without any kind of consultation with the region, that was quite, for me, when you see New Zealand's blunt end of foreign policies, we saw it even with the support for rollout of vaccines. I mean, New Zealand came to the table very late. There's this tunnel vision that it has in terms of its foreign policy, which is simply really looking at Polynesia. Let's face it. And I think that kind of really raises real questions around the wider Pacific. What is New Zealand's interest in the wider Pacific? We've seen, and I think Marco brought this up before, around the role of regional solidarity and the recent nomination of and recruitment of the Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum. What role did New Zealand play in that case? And you know, it's increasingly coming under the microscope because for many of us, we can see, you know, and I think it's partly to do with the symbolism of what you say and what you do. If your first foreign visit is to Indonesia and not to the Pacific, that's symbolic symbolism really, really matters. So I think it's true. We'll have to see how honest and true this new foreign policy is, the Pacific Resilience Policy. What does it really mean? Because the reset didn't happen in many ways for many of us to look at the way New Zealand projects in the region. But just to be clear, that New Zealand foreign policy is coming under a much more bigger scrutiny than ever before. You know, even for Pacific Islanders, we used to say, you know, Aotearoa is Pacific and Pacific is Aotearoa, but now we're not so sure. And when we look at some of these multilateral spaces like the WTO and what New Zealand is doing, it's quite frightening because it is so far from where our interests are and where we see alliances with New Zealand, because we're not squared up quite neatly on many fronts at the multilateral level. So I think foreign policy will come under scrutiny. We'll have to see where, you know, we can lean on New Zealand to support based on this long history that we've had with New Zealand. But I think increasingly we've got to recognize that if it adopts and behaves like Australia, we will run into very similar problems around, and this is the wider Pacific. Ron, what does it mean for New Zealand also and its foreign policy in the Pacific? Who's interested?
Those are amazing points by Maureen. Just to highlight the trade, the COVID, and broadly about the forum. That's absolutely fantastic. I think a lot of people see them as interlinked insofar as, you know, New Zealand taking that step back from, you know, trying to push for more integration with the Pacific through the 60s and 70s and then falling off when it tried to push neoliberalism to the Pacific broadly through PACER and its kind of descendants. Then as well with the COVID, the ability to say, you know, this is for Pacific safety. And then, you know, Mahuta doesn't visit the Cook Islands when there's a travel bubble. It was clear from the outset that New Zealand shut off all trade, kind of transit to the Pacific. You know, rightly so on one sense, but two, to make sure that the Australian travel bubble, Trans-Tasman travel bubble was prioritized. So the two were never going to coexist, you know. And then with the vaccine rollout, the kind of two-tiered, whether or not, domestic New Zealanders were getting Pfizer vaccines versus AstraZeneca vaccines, questions to do with, you know, their storage temperatures, but also, you know, where New Zealand would, after having secured superior vaccines, was going to send its other stock to the Pacific. Ongoing questions to do with RSC, and then broadly about, you know, New Zealand's role in the forum falling over, which itself it has had massive ramifications, the end of which we have not seen. You know, New Zealand gains a lot of its international political clout from its ability to positively kind of influence the Pacific through the forum towards good governance and transparency. But it's clear that the last meeting was not transparent. So yeah, just to echo how pertinent and kind of incisive Maureen's last points were. Yeah, truly.
So I hope all you listeners have enjoyed it. I've thoroughly enjoyed listening to you. Big round of applause, Maureen, Marco, Ian, for your contributions today. And I hope we can continue the conversation in one form or another. So thanks so much.